This is SQPN, the StarQuest Production Network, leading the way.
This episode of The Secrets of the Hobbit is brought to you by Bluehost. It's really cheap and really easy now to start your own blog or website. For just $6.95 per month, you get unlimited hosting, one-click installation of a WordPress blog, a .com domain name, and so much more. It's really good value. Go to sqpn.com/bluehost for more information. And by the Amazon store. Click on the link on our website, thehobbit.sqpn.com, before you shop at Amazon, and your purchase will help support our show.
sqpn.com presents The Secrets of the Hobbit.
There and back again. A Hobbit's Tale by Bilbo Baggins. Where to begin?
Welcome back to another episode of The Secrets of the Hobbit, the show that is most of the time weekly, and the show in which we look at what's going on in New Zealand and all the activity surrounding the two Hobbit movies currently in production. And joining me, as always, is my good friend Dave Cale. Hey, good morning, Dave.
Hello, Father. I'm glad we finally got this thing moving.
Yeah, sometimes we have to jump through a lot of hoops to get the technical aspect of the show ready to go. And
that's right.
It feels like we've just finished a podcast, and it is because I was a guest on your show, which is called Riddles in the Dark. And for those of our listeners that have no clue what that show is about, can you summarize it quickly?
Yes, sure. Basically, the point of it is to do really in-depth speculation about how the books and other stories that Tolkien tells will be executed and turned into stories on the big screen in the Hobbit films, and also to make specific predictions that we can decide whether they were right or wrong when the movie comes out, and keep track of scores, and somebody will end up being the winner. So it's got a nice sort of game element to it.
And what I like about the show is that it involves a lot of the high-profile Tolkien experts that are currently active, either with a podcast or with a blog or both. And so it's a great way to bring this big international fan base together in, I think, a very entertaining game.
Mm-hmm. I agree.
And of course, it is kind of a long-term game, because it's only when we see the first and the second movie that we'll get to see who actually won the game.
That's right. Yes, we're trying to be very careful. We're trying to make it to where all of the, or at least most of the predictions that we do this year, pertain to the first film, so that when the film comes out in November, we can, for, you know, 98% of the predictions we've done, we can go through and say yes, no, yes, no, yes, no.
Yes.
And then move on to predictions about the second film next year. But I'm sure there's going to be a couple things where we're just dead wrong about whether it would actually be in this film or something. So, but what we did do is we did add the stipulation for everything that we are making predictions about what will be on the screen in the theatrical release. So that, otherwise, if it was open to special features and things being released in the extended editions like 10 years from now, then this game would never end.
Yes, I think so too. But it's a very enjoyable way to pass the time between now and the moment that the first movie premieres. And
yes.
In a way, this period, this time waiting for the movie, for the first movie, is kind of almost a metaphor of the story itself, where it's the journey towards the treasure that is actually the most important part of the story.
Mm-hmm.
And the most enjoyable part of the story.
I totally agree. And actually, as a person who usually obsesses over, you know, oh, they changed this, they changed that, I don't like the way they did this, I find this very cathartic, because there are a lot of things where when we start out, we're like, oh, I really hope they do this the way it is in the book. And as we talk through it and then make our predictions, I end up concluding, obviously, that's not going to work. So I'm getting it out of my system now. I'm not going to be nearly as harsh on changes as I was with the Lord of the Rings films. And I think I'll find myself, I'm going to be like the people who gamble on sports games and then bet against their favorite team. I'm going to be sitting there thinking, do I want them to do it the way it is in the book, or do I want them to do it the way I predicted it so I can get a point?
Well, and even the Tolkien purist might be surprised, because we still don't know exactly how much is going to be changed or how much needs to be changed, or whether there are other ways to expand upon the original Hobbit story without kind of violating the canon that is put down by J.R.R. Tolkien himself. But we'll see. All that is part of the fun of that podcast. Is again, it's called Riddles in the Dark, and you can find it on Middle Earth Network Radio or on Middle Earth Network. And we'll include a link to the specific page dedicated to Riddles in the Dark in the show notes on our own website, which is thehobbit.sqpn.com. Let's take a look at the news.
You're done.
Confounded old Samwise Gamgee! Have you been eavesdropping?
I haven't been dropping no eaves, sir, honest.
What did you hear? Speak!
Nothing important. Please, Mr. Gandalf, sir, don't hurt me. Don't hurt me in anything unnatural.
So, Dave, what did you hear this week coming from New Zealand?
Well, the biggest news, in my opinion, is the fact that they've announced that HarperCollins acquired the exclusive worldwide publishing rights from Warner Brothers for writing the tie-in books to the Hobbit films.
The tie-in books. Now, is that just a – I mean, we don't need a novelization, I suppose, of the movie, because that's – the movie is based on a book. So what exactly does this entail?
I was trying to figure out too. What are they talking about? Tie-in books. But I think what they mean is things like the visual companion and books about the filmmaking.
Oh, of course.
Movie guides.
The children's version, the toddler version, the old people version.
Yep, exactly. And of course, also Houghton Mifflin will be doing the U.S. publication. So.
Okay.
Houghton Mifflin Harcourt is the U.S. one, and HarperCollins is the worldwide one. So I think HarperCollins – I think these are the two companies that did No, I'm wrong. But I do think HarperCollins did the Harry Potter stuff as well.
Ah, interesting.
I could be wrong about that.
And there were some excellent books surrounding the three previous Tolkien movies, the Lord of the Rings movies, and I've got actually a few of those really nice coffee table sized picture books, which are I love. Just browsing through them, because you know you can just sit back on the couch and just stare at the beautiful photos and at all the details that you don't even see if you watch the movie on DVD or on Blu-ray. So that's going to be very cool. Now, I wonder, you know, because we know that the story itself is going to be a blend of the original story of The Hobbit, but also added to that kind of the broader picture of what's going on and. Kind of like the backstory, as it were, of Middle Earth and what was happening with the ring and with the necromancer, etc. Do you think that the Tolkien estate or whoever owns the rights to the original books by J.R.R. Tolkien do you think that they would ever allow a novelization of the story of the movies to be written?
That's an excellent question. And like I said, when I first read this tie-in books, I was like, "What? Surely not! Surely they're not going to do a novelization of the film adaptation of a novel." Although it's not, I guess it's not that unusual to do that occasionally. Well, I don't know. For example, they didn't release when they did Jurassic Park 10 years ago. They didn't do a re-novelization of the film of the novel.
No, they didn't. Nor did they issue a special edition of the Lord of the Rings, Peter Jackson version.
Yeah, that's right.
But with this story,
right.
it could be interesting.
It's a little different in that they're not just taking the book and translating it to film, which means cutting stuff out, but they're actually adding in this big, you know, this wider story. Because usually when you do film novelizations, you have to fill out a whole bunch of details of the film. Obviously. they wouldn't necessarily need to, if they were just doing a straight up adaptation of the Hobbit book, they wouldn't need to do that here because the book already has all those details. But here what they're doing is really kind of a culmination of Tolkien's own evolution on the Hobbit. You know, this idea of rewriting it repeatedly until it finally has been fully incorporated into the epic mode of The Lord of the Rings, but also just his larger world of Middle-earth and mm-hmm. this greater greater mythology. Like, I could imagine him going back and actually referring to the Elven King as Thranduil instead of calling him the Elven King,
mm-hmm.
and specifying that the elves are, you know, where the elves came from and things like that. And those are things that I imagine they'll get a little bit into the film. And so you're right. You could see the potential to do that. I'm sure that the Tolkien estate won't let them.
And one could argue, of course, that it's not really necessary because a lot of the backstory that Jackson will include is based on, you know, all sorts of bits and pieces from the Silmarillion, from an epilogue, and so the bulk of the story is potentially already there in the original books. However, I think for someone who is new to the world of The Hobbit, it's quite something. It's quite a challenge to go and read The Silmarillion if you're not familiar with that universe.
Yes.
And to distill just the elements that are relevant to the story of The Hobbit.
Yes.
And there is something also. I mean, if purists would be angry about a potential, let's say, rewritten version of the Hobbit Plus or the Hobbit Extended Edition.
The Hobbit.
Then I'd say, you know, what's the difference between a book that is a bit expanded and a movie that expands a story? I mean, it's just two different media, but it's the same story. I don't see the difference morally between, you know, expanding the story in the form of a movie and expanding the story in the form of a book.
I think in theory I'm not opposed to the idea. So like, basically, if it was a true novelization of the film where Peter Jackson is making, you know, kind of the kinds of changes to the characters that he made to the Lord of the Rings characters to accommodate the film medium as opposed to fulfilling Tolkien's vision, and then that was just being re-novelized down. So like, if I'd gotten a Lord of the Rings novelization where Faramir behaved in the book the way he did in the film as opposed to the way he did in the original novel, I wouldn't like that. But if somebody could guarantee to me that they could hire a writer to do essentially finish Tolkien's job of rewriting The Hobbit in incorporating it into the larger story, I would be totally down with that. I would be fine with that. I'm just not convinced because it's not like he's doing something that Tolkien himself didn't see the need for. Tolkien wanted to do this. He wanted to change The Hobbit from a kid's story into a true prequel for The Lord of the Rings. He just kind of ran out of steam and time.
Yeah. Yeah.
So I'm sort of amenable to that idea. I don't think anybody would be able to – I'm just not sure anyone has the right to do it apart from maybe Christopher Tolkien or somebody from the Tolkien family. And maybe even they don't. Maybe it was J.R.R. Tolkien was either going to do it or it wasn't going to happen. I think we would all be very reluctant to accept something written by somebody else as like, this is Tolkien's final vision of The Hobbit.
Well, now, maybe we do accept stuff written by Christopher Tolkien, and he adds a lot to finish certain stories.
Well, I think if a Tolkien family member did it, maybe it would be more accepted. Maybe somebody will just eventually unearth a near complete manuscript for it that, you know, was buried in his backyard, and then they can just publish that.
How cool
with
would
a
that
few
be?
Changes.
But I think it's there are a lot of arguments actually against this project, and I think it would also probably create a lot of issues around, you know, copyright, and because of course the copyright of the actual film script is owned probably by Peter Jackson, or I don't know, perhaps they have a co-ownership, because the script itself is of course a different literary production from the book. It's based on the book, but it's not the book, and so there has to be a copyright holder on that. I don't know exactly how that works. But so even if we never get to see the novelization of the story told as we will be able to see it in the movies, what I know for sure will be published is the movie script, because the scripts for the Lord of the Rings trilogy are also available. And actually, you can find them online. I'm looking at the Internet Movie Script Database, and here in front of me on my screen is the entire script for the first movie of The Lord of the Rings. And it's a great read. It's very different, of course, than a book, because there are no descriptions. But if you've seen the movie and then you read through the script, it actually really helps you follow the story in a more detailed way, and you notice because you focus more on the dialogue. I really like reading through those scripts.
I've never actually read those. I should check those out.
I don't know if this is a fan transcript or if this is an authorized script, but it is pretty detailed. I mean, here, let's see. Bilbo jumps, a half-eaten pork pie in his hands as Gandalf mysteriously appears behind him. "Just tea, thank you," says Gandalf. "Oh, right. You don't mind if..." "No, not at all. Go ahead." A sudden loud knock on the front door. And then Mrs. Sackville Baggins off-screen. "Bilbo Baggins, you opened this door. I know you're in there." "I'm not home." Gandalf watches, amused as Bilbo tries to hide, etc. So that's the entire script. Anyway, we'll include links to that in the show notes. But do we know when the first of these books are going to be published? Is this going to be after the movie or a bit in advance?
I'm flipping through. I can't see much in the article. I don't think so. I don't think we know. Let's see here. Nope, there we go. November 2012. The multi-book deal includes 5 titles to be released in November 2012. I guess right around the time the film comes out. Maybe a little bit before, anticipating it, I bet. The Hobbit, An Unexpected Journey Visual Companion by Jude Fisher. The Hobbit, An Unexpected Journey Official Movie Guide by Brian Sibley. The World of Hobbits, The Hobbit, An Unexpected Journey Almanac. And The Hobbit, An Unexpected Journey Photo Storybook.
Nice.
Yep. And of course, this fall is the 75th anniversary of the publication of The Hobbit.
Very cool. Looking at the end of the article, and there's mention of the screenplays for both The Hobbit, An Unexpected Journey, and The Hobbit There and Back Again. It cites as the official authors of the screenplays Fran Walsh, Philippa Boyens, and then... interestingly enough, Guillermo del Toro, the previous director who stepped down, and Peter Jackson. So the 4 authors of the screenplays. But I don't see anything about whether or not those screenplays will be published.
And of course, they left out the unnumbered people that have done intermediate rewrites of it after they initially. I've learned through my girlfriend Teresa the intricate and complex rules of attribution of scripts. There's probably like 15 or 20 people that have actually contributed to the script at this point.
Wow.
Yeah.
And they rewrite dialogue and they speed up the overall script.
They just kind of pass it from one the main people finish it and pass it on to someone else who has to do some rewrites and go through it, and they pass it on to someone else. Although, for all I know, maybe, Peter Jackson has an unusual amount of control over these projects. And I remember seeing them in the special features on the Lord of the Rings DVD, rewriting it in their hotel room between shots and stuff. So maybe that's not quite true in this circumstance. But I think traditionally, I think a rule of thumb is that probably for any one film script where one or two people are listed as the screenwriters, that there's probably like 10 or 15 other people whose hands it's passed through that won't get credit.
Also, unfortunately, due to the fact that a lot of the original scripts that are pitched are so lousy that they need multiple rewrites, especially some of the big budget movies just get rewrite after rewrite after rewrite, and the final story that we see might have nothing to do with the original script, but it might still bear the name of the guy who came up with the idea, even though he has, there's nothing left of his story.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, that is, of course, part of the industry of movie making. But I guess you're right. I've got the feeling that most of the control over the direct control over the script, even while they are filming, is in the hands of Fran, Philippa, and Peter. And actually, it could be very advantageous to be able to change the script as you go and tweak it a little bit every day, and have those writers on your staff instead of, you know, having them live in LA and you have to wait for them to wake up or to go to bed before you can implement the changes.
Mm-hmm.
Hmm. Good. Excellent. So what else is new?
Well, let's see. I think there's two things that you probably want to talk about. There is this Ian McKellen interview, which is kind of interesting. There's not a lot of Hobbit material in there, but they do talk a bit about it, and they talk about the Lord of the Rings and Gandalf a fair amount. Yeah, and there's audio on that, so I imagine you probably want to play that at some point, but we don't have to do that yet.
Well, I'm just clicking on it and see what happens. It might give me another ad, so...
Yeah, probably.
Oh, no, wait a minute. No, actually, no. Here it is. Lord of the Rings over a decade ago now. The volume is a little bit low on this one.
Workplace, it became home for him. The Lord of the Rings trilogy, The Hobbit, years spent here living and working.
Years.
And after all that time, he's become so fond of the country, he wants to leave us with a farewell gift, a very personal fundraising effort for the century-old Isaac Theatre Royal, yet another victim of the Canterbury earthquakes. Rebuilding it will cost millions of dollars.
So fundraising wizard, it says on the screen.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, the audio volume on this YouTube video is a bit too low for me to play it here on the show, but it's always
cool.
Yeah,
we can maybe include a link to it in the show notes.
Yes.
Like I said, there's no like new Hobbit tidbits or anything like that, but it is a fun interview. He's a neat guy. Mm-hmm. He's always finding ways to give, it seems like.
Well, most of the crew actually is, and are a lot of the actors are involved in various fundraisers and charity projects, and I really like that.
And you know, he seems very well, kind of. He seems unusually. What's the right word to it? He seems unusually kind of accepting of the idea that his main acting legacy is going to be Gandalf. They talked about this, and he was talking
really?
About how, like, when he dies, he's sure that they'll put that on his tombstone and they'll mention that at his funeral. And he jokes about the fact that, but Gandalf never truly dies, does he? He's actually immortal, and laughs about that. But you know, he doesn't say that with bitterness or annoyance that he's, you know, all this other wonderful stage acting and stuff that he's done, that's never going to be as visible as what he's done with Gandalf. He seems okay with that, which I think it says a lot about him and obviously his love of Tolkien, you know, like that he's perfectly fine if he's remembered as Gandalf. Who better to be remembered as?
I wouldn't mind if I were in his place. And of course, he's played other iconic roles in big blockbuster movies. But the difference with, let's say, his role as Magneto in the X-Men movies is that they... since then moved over to, let's say, the younger generation of X-Men, and they did prequels, and in those movies, he no longer has the role of Magneto. So it's kind of, you have to share that with other actors, whereas with Gandalf, I mean, he is Gandalf, and no one else will play it. I mean, even in Harry Potter, with what's his name, the wizard.
Michael Gambon was the later Dumbledore, and
Dumbledore,
all of a sudden,
there you
I can't
go.
Remember the first guy's name.
No, but anyway, it doesn't matter. With Dumbledore, that role was played by two actors. So there's no definitive Dumbledore.
Richard Harris.
Harris, yes. And they both have had a very different interpretation. And there's still an ongoing debate as to who was the real Dumbledore. But with McKellen, I think he does a great job with Gandalf. And I guess that, of course, Saruman is another iconic wizard that has only been played by one actor. But what's his name again for Saruman?
Christopher Lee.
Christopher Lee, of course, he has played in so many movies. I think that McKellen's, let's say, trajectory in movies pales when you compare it to what Christopher Lee did. But it's great to see so many, you know, amazing actors attached to this project, because I think that the Hobbit deserves to have these high quality actors. Let's see. Some of which, by the way, will be forgotten, and others will be cherished for centuries to come. Where were we? I'm trying to find my show notes. Oh, here they are. There is a link in your show notes about the 48 frames per second frame rate of the Hobbit.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there was just, you know, this is something that they kind of just, the news just basically keeps rehashing it time and again, even though we've talked about it multiple times. But there were several new articles in the last couple of days about the 48 frames per second thing yet again. And I guess maybe this one's about how sort of the they are the theaters are working their butts off to try and make sure that they have the appropriate projectors and all the equipment they need to be able to actually project this thing in 48 frames per second, and that the manufacturers of the equipment are working overtime to try and make sure they've got it stuff.
Yeah, I'm reading here in the article that there are currently around 13,000 Sony 4K digital cinema projectors shipped worldwide. So 4K is, I think it's the highest resolution that you can get right now. It's, 1080p looks like very low resolution compared to 4K. And of course, The Hobbit and many other movies currently are recorded in 4K. But then downsampled for release on Blu-ray and for smaller theaters. And I guess, judging on what I'm reading here, what they will probably just upgrade those cinema projectors instead of having to ship new equipment. And but it will still be probably very costly. IMBs, integrated media blocks. Oh, there you go. So they can actually upgrade those projectors with a combined software and hardware upgrade, and that is called an integrated media block, and it does 48 frames per second and has 3D support. One IMB costs roughly $10,000, which is probably very cheap compared to what the overall cost of a projector is. But
yeah,
still,
it's definitely an investment to have this in place by the time The Hobbit comes out.
And you can bet that this is only worthwhile for the bigger theaters at first, because you have to make that money back. And $10,000 is a lot for smaller theaters.
Yeah.
So I don't think I'll be seeing The Hobbit here in Amersfoort anytime soon in 48 frames per second.
You know, what's really, I was scrolling down, apparently some people are even talking about trying to complete this upgrade by the summer, because they're anticipating a high frame rate trailer for The Hobbit.
Oh, interesting.
So, boy, do you think people will invest the money to upgrade their theaters just for the trailer?
I don't think so.
Yeah,
unless you really want to show off.
I think maybe I will. You have the option to go see those, because I'm sure the LA theaters probably, if they haven't already upgraded, they will. But I think a lot of them probably, it makes sense to do this because Avatar 2, James Cameron's Avatar sequels are going to be 48 frames per second or higher. So people figure, like, look, we might as well just pay this cost now, because we're going to be raking it in down the road.
Well, then, and then, of course, I think that the theaters are always looking for new reasons for people to go to watch a movie in theaters, and instead
that's
of watching
true.
It at home. And so 3D was of course a big thing, but that's kind of dwindling down. And 48 frames per second and like super high resolution is kind of the next thing. And it's interesting to see that the 4K displays are just around the corner.
Of course, right now, the televisions that can actually display 4K are still extremely expensive. I mean, you can buy probably a car for the for what you would spend on a screen like that. But a while ago, a high-definition screen, just 1080p, was we were talking about like $3,000 for just a small TV. Now, look at how much you pay now for a high-definition television. You can get high-definition computer monitors for $150. And so it is rapidly changing. And from what I've heard, the 4K television screens are you actually don't really need 3D because it looks as if you're watching through a window. The resolution is so high that it just... And combined with a higher frame rate, it tricks your mind into believing that what you see is actually taking place just behind the screen. So I imagine that a lot of theaters, but also movie producers, want to be future-proof. And I guess that Peter Jackson is kind of pioneering this technology. And soon we will see that a lot of production companies will follow him. And especially if the Hobbit is a financial success, you will see a lot of copycats thinking that, oh, as long as we do, let's say, Evil Death 53 in 48 frames per second, everybody will watch it. So you see a lot of kind of subpar movies that will think that just by copying the technology that Peter Jackson used, that they will be able to have the same success, which, of course, is it's not going to happen.
Did you see there's a tidbit toward the end where they mention how much data the cameras that Peter Jackson's using are generating? They say they're shooting 6 to 12 terabytes of camera data per day. It's unbelievable. That's so much data.
But it's not too bad. I mean, I've got a 2 terabyte hard drive. So yeah. Just times 6, that is just a couple of hard drives per day. That's not too much.
Yeah, I think for 265 days of photography, that's all.
That's a lot of hard drives. That is true.
Yeah.
Oh my goodness.
Man, oh man, and of course, because of their internet situation, I'm guessing they're not streaming this to the cloud somewhere. To some scalable storage. So they must be, maybe they are swapping in and out USB drives or something. Boy, that's got to suck.
Well, I guess with these kind of quantities, it probably pays off to just use special messengers. That's what we do with television production as well. You know, you everything is recorded on either. Well, we don't use tape anymore in Dutch television, but we use these kind of discs. It's a Sony system, and also increasingly these just solid state memory. And if you've been out filming and you don't have time to bring it to the editor, they'll just send a guy and he'll pick it up and usually. You make a safety copy, and so I guess that they have on location all sorts of redundancy archiving taking place, and then they will probably just bring those hard drives or whatever they use to the Weta studios in Wellington, and then from there I assume that they have very fast connections and they can send it all around the world if they need.
Yep.
All right. Well, why don't we take a short break and we'll get back to the news after that.
There and back again. A Hobbit's Tale by Bilbo Baggins. This is wonderful.
I meant to go back. Wander the paths of Mirkwood. Visit Lake Town. See the Lonely Mountain again. That age, it seems, has finally caught up with me.
Let me take a few seconds here to thank our sponsors. This show is brought to you by Bluehost. We're an affiliate of Bluehost, and Bluehost is a great hosting company. And what I like most about it, well, two things actually. I love the price, and I'm Dutch, so we are known for trying to save pennies always. For just $6.95 for a month, you get your own website. But the cool thing is of Bluehost is that
everything is unlimited. So the hosting space is unlimited, but also the transfer, the file transfer. So if your blog becomes an overnight success because it gets mentioned in a post by Peter Jackson and you get like 3 million hits in one day, if you have any other hosting company would charge you for the extra bandwidth that you would consume, and it could bankrupt you. But with Bluehost, it's a fixed price, so you'll never get in trouble. And you can actually become a millionaire for just $6.95 per month if your blog is very successful. But the second thing that I really like about Bluehost is that, I'm not a very technical person. So I'm lousy at installing a blog or uploading to FTP, and that's way too technical. I just want a blog. I just want to have a website. And what Bluehost offers you is actually one-click script installs. And so, for instance, if I want to set up a blog, a WordPress blog, which is the industry standard, it's basically, it's as easy as clicking a button, and then you wait for 5-6 seconds, and it will come back to you and say, your blog is now installed. And it's a full-fledged installation. And what makes it, I think, even more attractive is that they will also upgrade the software, even without you having to worry about it. So I just got a message the other day telling me that, hey, we are upgrading your server, and we're going to improve the speeds, we're going to improve protection. And I don't have to worry about that. They take care of that. And so not only are you able to install WordPress, but if you are a little bit more, like advanced with programming languages, you can install Joomla, Drupal. You can set up your own web store. So if you want to sell your own merchandise and get rich that way, they have all sorts of packages that you can install. And it's included in the price. You don't pay extra for that. To set up your own web store. If you want to set up your own forum, they've got the very famous PHP bulletin board software that you can install with one click. And I just think it's an awesome deal. They sometimes have promotions, like right now. Currently, you can set up a blog for even less. So it's now $4.95 per month for a limited time. So if you sign up for a Bluehost account, just make sure you go there via the link on our website. It's a banner that is on all our sqpn.com websites, so also on thehobbit.sqpn.com. I use it myself. Highly recommend it.
What's happening out there?
Shall I describe it to you? Or would you like me to find you a box?
And we're back with more news concerning The Hobbit. That almost sounds like a chapter title, concerning The Hobbit. Dave, what else can we tell our listeners?
Well, just for what it's worth, Father, there is the prologue in The Lord of the Rings that's titled Concerning Hobbits.
Well, there you go.
Yes.
Must have been in the back of my mind.
Well, if you don't mind talking a little more about the 48 frames per second thing, mm-hmm. Apparently at a few days ago at the Society of Motion Picture and Television Engineers meeting in Las Vegas, they actually did a demo or something of camera tests for The Hobbit and Unexpected Journey, showing various frame rates and shutter angles. And people were pretty impressed with how it looked, apparently.
Nice. Well, that's mm-hmm. good news. And this is about the industry experts, so I assume that the conditions were ideal. But let me see if there is... when you see high frame rate... This is someone who saw the demo, and the quote is, when you see high frame rate, it's like reality. Some people may find it disturbing because it seems like... what's happening in front of you is now no longer a flat moving painting. It looks real, and that's disturbing at first. I think there will be people that love it, and there will be people that say it looks like video, because video is the only way they can process something that looks too real, but it's really quite magical. And indeed, if you record something with your own camera, your own video camera, it's usually at 60 frames per second. And that just triggers our mind into... we associate that with cheap content. A lot of the soap series in the past were filmed with video cameras, and so they would be aired in 60 frames per second. And for some reason, we still have that association with, if it's 60 frames per second, it's not real. It's not a real movie. And mm-hmm. I think it's just a matter of conditioning, because actually the 24 frames per second speed is unnatural and is actually a very old-fashioned technology. And so I
really hope that movies like The Hobbit will help us make that transition to higher frame rates, and perhaps in a couple of years from now, we won't have that problem anymore. And right now, you can buy consumer cameras that are fully capable of filming at 60 frames per second, but they will offer you actually an option to dial it back to 24 frames per second. So it's a really kind of choppy video. And that's the only reason that they offer that is that a lot of people just love pretending that their amateur film is actually a high budget movie. But mm-hmm. It is kind of ridiculous that you're deliberately lowering the quality of what you film so that it looks more like a movie. It's comparable to the filters on Instagram, where you know people take beautiful high resolution color photos that they shot, and then they just make it look as if it was photographed in the 70s using a very cheap toy camera. It's like, why would you?
Yeah, there is a certain irony there.
Well, or the and this is something I've complained about a lot, both in this podcast, but also in other shows that I do, like The Break. This current trend of desaturating movies, The Hobbit, not The Hobbit, the Harry Potter series is an example of that. Where especially the later movies, they were dialing back the colors, and it almost looks like black and white, and it's or it becomes a really kind of high contrast, gritty video, and it's almost sometimes I feel like that's almost a cheap way to pretend that you're doing something fancy. And I'm like, well, perhaps in the future we'll look back at this era and we'll wonder, you know, why did they just remove all the colors from these movies, you know?
Yeah, when we had the ability to use color, why did we go back and do black and white looking films?
Yeah.
You're right. Harry Potter and the Half-Blood Prince, I really felt they did that and I hated it.
Yeah, me too. It's too much. And I can understand that you use that as a way to express the fact that everything is bleak, so it has a kind of a it's part of the visual storytelling, but then why should it be in every scene? And it becomes almost like a trick to make us believe that you're really doing something artistic. But I think it's a fad ultimately, and it's going to be just as much kind of old-fashioned as when you think back of a movie like Gladiator, remember that one? Or the movie 300?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
It was this trend of filming battle scenes in a very low frame rate, sometimes 12 frames per second. So it's like half of what we normally have in the cinema. And then they would use a long lens, which means they would film the action from very far away. And it would create this almost stroboscope type of action, you know, where you're like, especially if you watch fighting scenes like that. I remember seeing Gladiator in the theater, and I was kind of close to the screen, and I could not figure out what was going on, and because it was just almost like I was looking at different slides. Like every few seconds there would be a different slide. Very choppy.
Very disorienting.
In 300 was the same thing. And I recently saw this also in The Hunger Games, where they used the same technique. Now, Hunger Games is kind of strangely enough, a pretty low-budget movie. And so in order to kind of spice up the action scenes and the fighting scenes, they used that same technique. But I was like, wow, this looks like old-fashioned Gladiator-style filming. They don't need to do that now. We're so past that.
Yeah, Hunger Games, they did some weird things. Like, particularly, or you know, in the first part of the film, they wanted it to feel sort of like a almost documentary style. So they did a lot of the handheld, shots with the camera moving a lot. And that was really annoying.
Yeah, especially if you watch it on a big screen. I don't think it's going to be a problem on DVD, on Blu-ray, because you're watching that on a smaller screen. So there is less jitter, but I don't know. How did we get to talk about this whole thing? It's about these fads that come and go. So,
yes.
Anyway, I hope that and Peter Jackson in Lord of the Rings also
kind of did these very grayish scenes. And I don't know what the overall look will be of The Hobbit.
But he intermixed them with really colorful scenes. Yes. Rivendell was really colorful.
You're right. You're right. And the Shire, too. Yeah. And I think that his use of color and grading the movie was actually part of the language, and he used colors to express a certain mood. And so the more things turn grim, well, the less colorful it becomes. And then with the third movie, of course, the destruction of the ring, it all kind of the fire is so red and so yellow that it just kind of it has more impact because you've been looking at all those gray images devoid of colors for such a long time. And so the impact of the color once it appears is so much bigger. So that, I think, is an intelligent use of color grading. But we'll have to wait and see for The Hobbit. Judging from the trailer, it's very colorful, actually. And there were a lot of kind of brown, warm tones in there. So, what else? Do we have another article about this, the projection? Or?
Well, there's an interview with Luke Evans, who's, you know, obviously one of the actors in it, in Collider. The website collider.com. And anyway, he did an interview with Collider about various things, and they asked him a little bit about The Hobbit, and most of the conversation ended up being about the new filming technology. Mm-hmm. So there's not a lot of new information. It's not worth getting into details, but basically he just says that he's pretty impressed by it, and then he's excited to be making sort of technology history as well as film history. So
nice.
The listeners should totally go check that article out.
Now, apparently, new portraits have been painted by, let's see, who made those?
Ross Watson, an Australian artist.
And the paintings of Stephen Fry and Luke Evans.
Mm-hmm.
Now, are these Hobbit-related, or is this just portraits?
Yeah, I think so. Well, I don't know. That's a good question. I don't know if the paintings themselves are actually Hobbit stuff, but I guess basically, I don't know. That's a good question. What I'm reading from Middle Earth News is just that Hobbit actor Stephen Fry and Luke Evans sat for paintings by Australian artist Ross Watson last weekend. Okay, obviously it's not Hobbit related. Fry, who loves his gadgets, was painted with his iPod.
Okay.
So that answers that. He had to hold on to his precious.
Interesting. I'm looking at the website of the artist, rosswatson.com, and you see some photos of him and Stephen Fry and I guess
Stephen Fry had a farewell brunch since he was leaving New Zealand after finishing his filming, and they invited Ross Watson to this, and it sounds like this was a pretty fun brunch. They said he laughed at Billy Connolly's jokes, talked to Ian McKellen over passion fruit, sponge cake, and tea, and then he had dinner with Luke Evans. So
nice.
Mm-hmm.
Let's see. Martin Freeman and Tom Hollander, another Bilbo candidate, co-star in short film.
Yes.
Tom Hollander, was he a Bilbo candidate?
Yes, he was.
Was he? He was in the running. I didn't know that they ever divulged who else was kind of a runner-up. It's normally
this was mentioned somewhere back in 2011. There's an article about it on Middle Earth News again.
Mm-hmm.
Just that Tom Hollander basically said that he auditioned for Frodo and Bilbo. So I think he auditioned for both roles, maybe even auditioned for Frodo in Lord of the Rings. So he just never could quite break through, I guess. Although he's done quite well for himself since he was in Pirates of the Caribbean.
Hmm. So I'm looking at a picture of Tom Hollander and he looks very different from Martin Freeman, but he actually does look like a hobbit with a curly hair and everything. He's got a slightly more round face. I think he could actually pass for Bilbo now that we're all used to Martin Freeman playing Bilbo. But if you look at the description and previous artwork, especially from the animated movie that is already out there, Tom Hollander actually matches the Bilbo profile a little bit more than Martin Freeman.
Yep. So I think he could have done a fine job.
Yeah.
So, but apparently he landed this role in this film called The Voorman Problem. It's a short film, sort mm-hmm. of an indie type thing. And he actually recommended Martin Freeman for the role that's opposite of him. So apparently he's not bitter about not getting Bilbo.
Well, you can always say, I almost was Bilbo. But it would be the same thing as, remember a couple of episodes ago, we talked about, what's the, like the casting for The Lord of the Rings, and we almost got, what's his name again? The National Treasure guy?
Ghost
Rider.
Nicolas Cage.
Nicolas Cage. He could have been part of The Lord of the Rings.
Yeah, I don't even want to think about that. I just watched him in that movie. Pardon my language, Kick-Ass. I don't know if you ever saw that.
Oh, yeah.
He's such a weird guy.
Well, actually, he wasn't too bad in that one. I really didn't like his Ghost Rider movies.
I don't think he would have worked out as Aragorn, though.
Aragorn? Was he in for Aragorn?
Yeah, that's what he says.
Oh, boy.
You know, all these people keep saying, like, oh, yeah, I was up for that role. I don't know if we should be believing them or not.
Hey, I was up for the role of Darth Vader once.
Yeah, I'm sure.
For some reason, it didn't go through. But and then I wanted to play, let's say I also auditioned for a lightsaber and a dead stormtrooper. But for some reason, they didn't think
they didn't
I was...
give you dead stormtrooper?
No, they didn't. They told me that my accent was too Dutch. too bad. Ian McKellen attends Olympic countdown party in Wellington. What is that?
Well, there's there's an article in the sports section of the Dominion Post on stuff.co.nz, and basically I'm wondering if a lot of the sort of Commonwealth nations, old British colonies and stuff, are doing these kinds of events to celebrate the 2012 London Olympics. But I guess there was a 100-day countdown festival that began with a 100-meter run up a hill, up Hill Street in Thorndon on April 18th. Or at least that's when the article is posted. And they're just mostly talking about this and how it's a celebration of the London 2012 Olympics. But then they add a little tidbit that they say among those who were celebrating at the party was the Hobbit star, Sir Ian McKellen, who said he was looking forward to leaving Middle-earth to return to London and celebrate the sporting and cultural events on offer during the Olympics. If you can't get tickets to see the high jump, you can always get to see Hamlet, he said.
Smart. Little pitch for his other work.
That's right.
Excellent.
So that's really all that we have there. But boy, Ian McKellen really gets around, doesn't he?
He is everywhere. Yeah. It's going to be strange for all those actors to return to their normal life, because for them, most of the filming is over, except for potentially some pickup shoots for the second movie. But once they're done, that's where the big work still begins for, well, it's already in progress. But of course, post-production mm-hmm. is still going to take a long time for Weta Studios. And so once the promotion for the movies kicks in, they actually have to switch back to, something that they did like more than a year ago and reminisce about all the adventures on location in Middle-earth. But it looks as if they had a great time in New Zealand.
So yes.
I bet you that we'll see lots of behind-the-scenes videos on the DVDs and on the Blu-rays. Showing, the bonding of the crew in between the scenes, and we'll get to see the wrap up party. And remember the last extended edition of Return of the King, where they filmed this this scene where it was, I think, the last scene with Frodo, and Peter Jackson just kept reshooting it time and again. He just literally couldn't say goodbye to his actors.
and to Frodo. Uh-huh. And it was just this very emotional, and it just goes on and on. It's like, cut, let's do that again. Cut, let's do that again, like 20 times. And every performance was perfect already. But it was such an amazing glimpse of how much Peter Jackson was emotionally involved in his actors and in the process that he just didn't want it to stop. Mm-hmm. And so I wonder if we'll see kind of the same emotion, because we don't know if Peter Jackson will ever return to Middle Earth. There's been some speculation about potential, you know, kind of a film version of the Silmarillion. Did you pick up on any of that?
I'm not buying it.
Me neither, but
because somebody mentioned this in the chat room during the Riddles in the Dark episode we did the other day, and I was Googling it, and all the real news stories that I can find are from like 3 or 4 years ago, and they're all just rumors. Mm-hmm. I'm sure there's people with you know who see piles of gold who are trying to find a way to do it. I have it on good authority through official channels, through my contacts at Warner Brothers Interactive Entertainment. What they have told me is that there's no way it's going to happen until Christopher Tolkien has passed away, which is kind of an awful, horrendous thing to say. But basically, Tolkien Estate owns all the Silmarillion trademarks and copyrights and all that still. They haven't – Saul's Entz has the copyright for Hobbit and Lord of the Rings adaptations, not the books. But they don't have any Silmarillion copyrights yet. And my understanding is that Christopher Tolkien has just like laid down the law and said, no Silmarillion adaptations, as long as I'm around. This person told me that his children, J.R.R. Tolkien's grandchildren, mm-hmm. are more, maybe more persuadable. But my understanding is that one of them in particular is a huge video game fan and feels that the Silmarillion might be better adapted as like a computer or video game experience as opposed to a film.
I wouldn't be opposed to that.
Yeah. I think I'm in Corey Olson's kind of thought. I have a similar attitude to him. Like, I just think it'll end up being a disaster.
I don't know. It depends on who's going to be involved, and the story itself doesn't lend itself, to a big budget movie form. But perhaps something else. I don't know. Television series? Mm-hmm. I have no idea. Anyway,
Game of Thrones style HBO miniseries.
I would really like that, but
yeah, I'd rather they do that. It's gonna feel a lot more like those books, I think, than the Lord of the Rings or the Hobbit type films. The book, I think, lends itself more to that medium. But still, you know, there's not a ton of dialogue and really sort of down-to-earth type characters.
No.
It's so mythic and the language is so elevated that they really have to work hard to adapt.
Oh, it would require extensive rewrites and a lot of creativity to kind of fill in the characters and make it work. But I think that the Silmarillion would be better for an episodic approach rather than for a big budget movie. But I don't know. So for Peter Jackson, this might actually be the last time that he spends in Middle Earth. And so could be even more emotional than Lord of the Rings. Although at the time he thought that was going to be his last Tolkien project, and it wasn't. So who knows?
It's true. Who knows?
Links to all the stuff that we've been talking about, as usual, can be found on our website, thehobbit.sqpn.com. You can follow us on Twitter. We are Hobbit Podcast on Twitter. And we also have a Facebook page. Just look for Secrets of the Hobbit. If you like this show and you want to help us spread the word and get more people to listen to it, why don't you give us a review on iTunes? It's very easy. If you download it from the page, you can also leave a review. And, well, help us promote the show by telling your friends and family about it. And most of all, of course, your fellow Hobbit fans. We will be back very soon with another episode in which we hopefully have more news to report. But for now, this is it. See you soon. And may the hair on your toes grow ever longer, or something hobbity like that.
SQPN, leading the way in Catholic new media.